In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Pollan. He's a journalist who has done a lot of writing about the relationship between people and nature. He's authored several books, including Second Nature, A Place of My Own, and The Botany of Desire. And we'll talk this morning about his new book, which is titled The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. It is published by the Penguin Press and is out now and available in bookstores. And the book takes off from what might seem to be an innocent enough question, the question being, what should we have for dinner? But as he explains in the book, answering that question has become very complicated because every day we are bombarded with information about food. And it becomes very difficult to figure out, for example, which foods are best for our health or which systems of production are best for the environment. He says that America is in the grip of a collective eating disorder. And he says the more we worry, the less healthy we seem to become. So in this hour, we'll talk about the food we eat and where it comes from. Michael Pollan is a longtime contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. He teaches journalism at Berkeley, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Pollan, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. The thing I think that, as I said, the kind of issues that you deal with in the book, you've been writing about for a long time, but you explain in the issue that in the book that perhaps the thing that most got you going, that maybe led you in this direction, was back in 2002. Folks will remember this, when the low-carb or no-carb diet fad was just peaking, and people were going out of their way to avoid carbs. It was really bad for people who were in businesses like baking, for example. Artisan bakers were just tearing their hair out because so many people were deciding that they weren't going to eat bread. I think we're past that now, but it just shows you how a particular odd kind of diet idea, if it gets enough attention, can grab hold of people.
Yeah, I mean, it just what it showed me was that we were really vulnerable to food fads in a way that very few cultures are. A culture's eating habits are one of the most stable things about it. If you think about it, that's really what defines a culture in large part. If you think, you know, what is French culture? What is Italian culture? I mean, a good part of that, it's not just art. It's not just language. It's the way people eat. And we don't seem to have a very strong food culture in this country, or we wouldn't be liable to completely change the way we eat overnight, as happened, as you rightly say, with the low-carb mania. There was basically a single newspaper article got that whole thing started in the summer of 2002, and overnight, you know, we completely changed the way we ate. And not only were bakers pulling their hair out, they were going out of business. Pasta companies were going out of business. Donut stocks were collapsing. It was hilarious, actually. You could not get a crust of bread at a dinner party on the East Coast, at least, if your life depended on it. Bread disappeared from the table. This is one of the staples of human life. And, you know, that's what cued me into the fact that there was something very peculiar about our attitude toward food, that we would be listening to these kind of health messages from so-called experts and be willing to overthrow the whole menu. Yeah, it's moderated, but we're vulnerable to the next one. It'll be, you know, omega-3s or you know, the omega-3 diet or something like that next. I you know, that's what I mean when I talk about a national eating disorder. I mean, a culture that really doesn't know how to go about feeding itself without lots of help from experts has a problem, and it does produce an awful lot of anxiety. And the irony is that the more we worry about food and what we should and shouldn't eat, the less healthy we seem to get. Because these cultures that don't worry so much, and I point again to the French and the Italians or the Japanese, who just kind of go along with the food culture they've inherited from their parents and grandparents, they're healthier than we are.
Yeah. It's interesting when you think about human beings and their diet that, as you point out, there are some animals that may only eat one thing, and they're genetically programmed to eat that. They see that, they recognize it as food, nothing else is. But as far as humans are concerned, human beings can and do eat anything that you can eat. There's probably somewhere in the world where people are eating anything that's edible. they're eating it. And that it's interesting that this wide, the wide palate that we have to draw from, all these different things that we can eat, sort of interesting idea that actually could turn out to be a problem or anxiety-inducing.
Yeah.
Just because there are so many choices available.
It's a blessing and it's a curse. It's a blessing because if you're an omnivore, which we are, we can eat all different kinds of things, you can find something to eat just about anywhere on the planet, and it is what has allowed our species to, occupy six different continents of the seven, and find things to eat even when our preferred kinds of foods have gone extinct. The curse part is, if you can eat so many different things, and you're not hardwired by genes to know exactly what to eat, because we're not, unlike the koala bear, who, as you say, knows exactly what to eat. If it's not a eucalyptus leaf, it's not dinner. that leads to a lot of anxiety. There are the okay foods to eat and the dangerous foods to eat. And so all omnivores have that anxiety about food, and that's what I mean by the omnivore's dilemma. So it is a blessing and a curse. The problem for us is that as creatures, we have had a good system for separating the okay foods from the dangerous foods, and that is our culture. The fact that we can perform kind of a trial and error experiment on a mushroom. Some poor soul will, taste the death cap mushroom and keel over and die. And the news of that will spread through the human population. And in fact, we'll attach a name to that mushroom, the death cap. And that's a handy reminder to people who live thousands of years later that that's not a good one to eat. So in other words, it's culture. It's human culture that encodes the good and bad information about food. And, rats don't have that. Cockroaches, who are also generalist eaters like us, don't have that. They have to perform that trial and error every generation.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of lucky that way. But when that food culture breaks down, and when I talk about a food culture, I'm talking about a cuisine, a set of manners, a taboos. You eat this, you don't eat that, or you eat this in that order. You have the sweets after you have the main course. You eat at mealtimes with groups. You eat three times a day. All this kind of stuff, all this information that's helped us navigate this very bountiful but also treacherous food landscape. That's what I mean by a food culture, and that is what I think is in trouble in this country.
Yeah, the one thing that you touch on, and I think it's just a fascinating thing to think about, is that that story of how it is that human beings figured out what was good to eat and what was not, and as you say, it must have been a very large process of trial and error, and some people got sick, and some people died, and as you say, someone ate something and died. Whoever was left looked at that guy and said, well, I guess we shouldn't eat that.
Yeah.
And then they went on. And the advantage that we have, as you say, over perhaps other animals is that we could that became part of our institutional memory. And we said every time we saw that thing, we said, well, you remember what happened to the person who ate that. So we want to stay
Don't
away from
do it.
It.
Yeah. And on the other side, somebody tried a lobster, and which doesn't look like a very promising food. And return with the very good news that not only would it not kill you, but it was really tasty and nourishing. And that information has been preserved as well.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Michael Pollan. His new book is The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. It's published by the Penguin Press. And maybe I should explain the title a little bit. And what he does in the book is take a look at different means of production and the kind of food that results going from major kind of industrial food, and I suppose the big example of that would be to McDonald's, to some other kinds of more sustainable, more organic alternatives kind of in the middle. And in the end, actually, you went out hunting and gathering. So you sort of went from the one extreme of industrial food to perhaps as close as you could get to the other idea of actually going out and foraging and providing for your food that way.
Yeah, I wanted to look at both the longest, most complicated food chain that we're a part of, which is the meal that ends, the food chain that ends in a McDonald's meal, basically, or a supermarket meal. And then the shortest and most elemental. I wanted to really get back to the essence of this relationship with other species, that is eating. And so I felt I had to learn. I'm really not a hunter type of person. I'd never hunted before, but I learned to hunt, and and also gather mushrooms, which was, you know, equally challenging. And I even, you know, went salt hunting, gathering salt for this meal. I wanted to make one meal that was completely hunted, gathered, and grown by me, which was, it's nothing I'm proposing as a solution to the problems of the food system, but because I you don't need more people like me out in the woods with guns, God knows. But but as an educational process to remind us that in the end it is not industry that feeds us, it is nature that feeds us, it is these other species. You know, it's a wonderful way to remind yourself of that, and as an almost ritual activity. I learned a lot. I came out of that experience with a new respect for hunters and what they know about food and nature and our relationship to other species.
Well, we'll try and talk about both of those things. We do have a couple of callers, and rather than make them wait, we'll get right to them. Folks can also help us by being brief, of course. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. First in line here is a caller in Kankakee. This is line number 4. Hello.
Your caller would humbly suggest that Mr. Pollan's book is the most essential reading that Focus 580 listeners can undertake at the present time, and suggest that a move toward meals number 3 and 4 are necessary for the preservation and enhancement of the tilth of our land and the health of our people. Your caller would appreciate the author's comments. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, first, thank you very much for saying that. I really appreciate that. You know, I agree that changing the way we eat is vital to solving our very unhealthy relationship with the land and the environment. And that although we don't pay as much attention to our eating as we do, say, the way we drive or heat our houses or entertain ourselves in terms of damage to the environment, it is just as important. The way we're feeding ourselves consumes almost a fifth of all the fossil fuel we eat, because it's such a energy-intensive and long-distance way to eat. And the failure of the soils. I mean, people in your listening area know this better than people on the coasts where I live. But the failure of soils leads to the failure of civilizations. We've seen that over and over again, and we are treating our soil like dirt. And through industrial agriculture, through, you know, using far too much nitrogen fertilizer, far too many pesticides, we're killing the soil. And that is suicide for any civilization. And so finding a new way to feed ourselves from the land, which we are, by the way. I mean, it is a period of great promise and ferment. I met remarkable sustainable farmers doing remarkable work, growing vast quantities of food from small amounts of land that they are leaving in better shape than they found them. Gave me a lot of grounds for hope. I mean, this is a book that you know, shines a light on a very serious problem, which is the problem of industrial agriculture and industrial eating, which are tied together, which is an environmental problem and a public health problem. But it is just as much a book about the solutions to this problem, and I found a lot of very, very promising solutions.
Well, let's talk with someone here on a cell phone. This is line number 1. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to bring out a couple of interesting facts that might be interesting to discuss. One of the things that has happened over the last 30 years is the cost of food per family, as far as their proportion, has dropped from like 25% down to around 12 or 13%. So the amount of food that people can eat now has considerably increased proportionally, because it's cheaper for them. In addition, because of the mass producing of certain crops, I think we're always reflective of what is the most profitable food or most preservable food, which is often the most profitable food. whether it's grains or alcohol or sugar that can preserve food. And these things have a big bearing on whether or not how much we're going to eat and what price they are and what's going to be advertised to us. And I think, you know, and being a historian, that previously we were just concerned about short-term survival, just enough food to sustain ourselves, not to maintain ourselves a longevity, which has changed today. And I think because people are living a lot longer. So I think all these complications have come in, have really changed the how we're looking at our diets today compared to what we may have looked at 150 years ago. Whereas somebody that was obese might have been considered wealthy because they had enough money to consume that much food. And whereas today, it is not considered a sign of wealth. It's considered often considered a sign of many other things that are not socially acceptable. But I think if we look at the reasons behind our industry selling products that are very profitable and easy to produce, then I think we can understand why we're in the state we're in today.
I think you make very good points, and it's really important to bring that historical perspective to this situation because a lot has changed, especially since World War II and the way we feed ourselves. The caller actually underestimates how cheap food has gotten. It's down in the last, the USDA is just about to announce the new figures for the percentage of our income that goes to feeding ourselves, and it's down under 10%. We're spending less than any people in the history of the world and any other people on Earth today on food. And, you know, at the simplest level, when food gets really cheap, people will eat more of it, especially when the food scientists have so cleverly engineered that food to be intensely sweet and fatty. I mean, we are hardwired to respond to sweetness and fat, and they know how to push those evolutionary buttons to get us to eat more. Not to mention the fact you have $36 billion in food marketing money spent every year to help us eat more and eat at more different occasions and more different places. So, you know, we are up against a major historical change. And, you know, and at the bottom of all this, and something we haven't talked about, is the way we're eating now is tied very closely to agricultural policy and the fact that our government has a set of policies designed to encourage the overproduction of corn and soybeans and wheat, these cheap grains that can be converted into some very unhealthy foods. And we do not support the growing of fresh produce in this country in the same way.
I'd like to make out one other point, is the fact that scientists have discovered that if you keep your calorie intake probably around 1,000 or less, that you actually increase your longevity potentially. And that's definitely against the whole system of our food selling in this country.
Yeah, that's a message that doesn't get out, that some of the clearest correlations between longevity and eating, or in fact cancer prevention and eating, is calorie restriction. But who makes money selling less food? There's nobody. Everybody makes more money selling more food. And so that there are messages. Eat less is a very simple message, and it's a very profound message from, you know, from a health point of view. But no one has a stake in getting that message out.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. I'll tell you what I should do is introduce again our guest, and I want to come back to this point of particularly these different food chains, and talk some more about the industrial food chain. But let me again just real quick mention that our guest is Michael Pollan. He is the author of the new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. It's published by the Penguin Press. He's written three other books, Second Nature, A Place of My Own, and The Botany of Desire. That was a bestseller, was named Best Book of the Year by Borders, Amazon, and the American Booksellers Association. He's a longtime contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. He teaches journalism at Berkeley, and he's joining us by phone, and other people can do that too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You looked at different food chains, different ways of how it is that food gets from the beginning to the end, that is, from where it's produced and how it's produced and how it's processed and how it ends up on our tables. The biggest one, the most important, the industrial food chain, is based on, as you explain in the book, is based on a very small number of plants. And of those small number of plants, the most important is corn. And it ends up in an awful lot of processed food, an awful lot of food that Americans eat. Now, out here where we live, corn and soybeans, they're the two big agricultural crops. So we're no doubt getting into what may well be controversial territory. But let's talk about that, or to talk about what the problem is with having the diet of so many Americans be so heavily based on corn and or things that are made one way or another, made out of corn.
Well, it's just a dangerous way to eat, and it's a dangerous way to farm. When you're growing too much of one thing, you know, you have a monoculture. And as every farmer will tell you, monocultures are very precarious things. They're much more liable to disease and pests of all kinds. They take a great deal of technology, and particularly chemical technology, to keep healthy. And it's not the best use of the land to reduce it to one or two crops. Nature doesn't work that way. Nature practices diversity, polyculture, not monoculture. And she tends to destroy monocultures over time. So at the level of the land, it's a dangerous way to grow your food. At the level of the eater, it's also a dangerous way to eat. We are, as we said earlier, omnivores. We really need 40 or 50 different chemical compounds and minerals to be healthy. You know, the cow can get everything it needs from grass. That's a remarkable thing. But we can't. We can't get everything we need from one or two plants. We need a great many different plants. And to be eating a diet that is essentially, you know, corn energy and soybean protein converted into fast food, we do not get all the different chemical compounds we need. So that you have a problem that, you know, local doctors here have told me about, where you have children coming into health clinics in the inner city in Oakland who are overfed, they're overweight, they live on a diet of fast food, yet they suffer from nutritional deficiencies like rickets. That we thought were associated with undereating. And that's because their diet's simply not giving them the variety of chemical compounds, the calcium, the folate, all the things that they need. So, you know, look, this idea of eating from one plant or two plants, you know, the Irish had a disastrous experiment with that in the 19th century. They were the people of the potato in the same way we are now the people of corn. And what happened? Well, one day, and it was virtually one day in 1845, the potato crop failed. A fungal disease hit it, and all the potatoes in the ground turned to mush virtually overnight, and a million Irish starved. Are we in that sort of vulnerability with corn? I would say not to that extent, because we are not as dependent on corn as they were on the potato. But farmers who go back far enough will remember in 1970, the corn crop was decimated by a single disease because the genetics were so uniform. And we had to go back to Mexico and find some wilder varieties of corn to refresh the genome. So it's, you know, it's just not wise to put all your eggs in one basket, either as a grower of food or an eater of food. And that's what I'm afraid we're doing by letting corn colonize our landscape and colonize our diets and colonize the diets of the animals we eat, too. One of the more interesting experiments I did in my book was take a McDonald's meal and, with the help of a scientist here on campus at Berkeley, put it through a mass spectrometer to see where did the carbon that's in that meal, and of course it is mostly carbon, where did that carbon come from? And I was astonished to learn that the identity of that carbon is preserved through the whole process. Even as you turn corn into, say, high fructose corn syrup to make soda, you can still identify it as corn-based carbon at the end of that process. And what we found is that McDonald's meal is you know, the majority of it is corn. The hamburger, the salad dressing, even the French fries had a lot of corn in it. Now, how's that? Well, corn oil. If you fry potatoes in corn oil, a lot of the carbon that you're ingesting is corn. So we have become the corniest people on earth. And that is, you know, partly a testament to the incredible strides in productivity of farmers in your part of the world, each of which can feed over 100 Americans by growing such a vast amount of corn. But they would be feeding us better if they could find a way to grow more different things. And I know the system is very much loaded. You know, the elevator only buys corn and soybeans. You can't bring a truckload of broccoli to the elevator. So it's a systematic problem. I'm not blaming farmers for this. They're plugged into a system that they're not in a position to change. But the consumer is in a position to change it and send a market signal that there are other things we'd like our farmers to be growing. Mm.
Well, you lead us to the next area here. We know that there are certainly significant numbers. I'm not sure how much. They're certainly not the majority, but a lot of Americans who are concerned about the food they eat, its impact on their health. They're interested in how it's produced. And so there now is a growing demand for organic, whatever that means. And that's sort of the big question mark here, is that you know that by saying that there are certain people that will respond to that, and by saying that something is organic, you can get people to buy it. And in fact, there are some people who'd be willing to pay a premium for something that is organic because they think that that's better. The question now, though, is, well, what exactly does that mean? And you write about the fact that there is now industrial organic food, mm-hmm. which sort of raises the question of what are people getting? What do they think they are getting? And whether, in fact, if we do that, if we do organic production but on an industrial scale, whether, in fact, that's really very much better than the other kind of industrial food production that you've just been talking about?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I mean, organic is not a meaningless word by any means. I mean, it has a very specific definition that has now been codified by the federal government. And if you buy organic food, you are getting a different product that is arguably a better product. It is grown without synthetic pesticide, without synthetic fertilizer. It is certainly better for the soil in which it grew, and probably better for the eater, although the science is still a little sketchy. But it seems to me avoiding atrazine in your food or some of the other pesticides we spray on our food is probably better for you than ingesting them. We shouldn't just muddy the water too much and say no one knows what organic is and it doesn't mean anything. It does mean something. However, as organic has grown, it has, as you say, industrialized. And what that means is that the image many people have of that organic farm as a small family farm, you know, lovingly, you know, some hippie farmers lovingly tending the earth and personally taking care of every apple, is no longer the case. Organic farms are very often really quite large. And the organic food chain is coming to resemble the conventional food chain. So, for example, you have organic feedlots where they're fattening cattle on organic corn. That's an exact mirror of the feedlot system for industrial, conventional agriculture. And it's not a very good one for the cows and for the eaters of those cows because, you know, ideally cows should get to eat grass and not corn. So is feeding them, you know, organic corn any better? I don't think it is much better. I think we have to realize what organic can contribute, and it is important, but I think we have to go beyond organic and be looking at truly sustainable farming. One of the problems with organic is it's just as energy intensive as conventional, and in some ways more, because if you don't use an herbicide on your fields, you've got to do a lot of weeding, either by machine or by hand. So it's very labor-intensive. You know, we forget, but all these agricultural technologies we've come up with, whatever their problems, are great labor-saving devices. That's why that single farmer in Illinois can grow enough food to feed 120 Americans, and only by, you know, actually working the land a few weeks a year. It's an astounding accomplishment, and it depends on technology. But if you're growing, say, organic lettuce in California, and you are washing it and boxing it in plastic and shipping it to an eater in New York, you are using a huge amount of energy. And you may call that lettuce organic, but is it really sustainable? We did a calculation in the book, and to move one calorie of organic lettuce, food calorie of organic lettuce, to a plate of an eater in New York City takes 57 calories of fossil fuel energy. By any measure, that is is not a sustainable meal. But you know, it's organic. So you know, the original definition of organic, though, would have frowned on that kind of behavior, because the whole idea was to grow food with a lighter environmental footprint.
Well, there, and, you know, as you said, it's not the case that saying something is organic doesn't mean anything, but it certainly has become a marketing strategy, and people have built a industry around selling food that is organic. But I guess that, again, that gets back to this idea of how do you know what it is that you're buying? And it is now, for example, in a lot of places possible for people to actually have some contact with the producers.
Yeah, you know, here I think that's very important.
In our area, for example, I know that there are people here locally. They're producing eggs. They're producing various kinds of meat. They're producing all kinds of produce. We have a farmer's market here once a week. You can go down there. You can meet some of these people. You can see the stuff. In some cases, you can actually, if you want to, go to their farm and kind of see what it's about. So this is the reflection of a larger kind of movement like this that's been going on for a while, certainly in some places, to get people more aware of where the food comes from and actually perhaps have some contact with people who produce it and encourage people to support and buy from local producers. So, you know, it may indeed be possible to do that, but I'm not sure everyone can do that, which gets me back to this question of, you know, no matter what it says on the package or in the bin in the store where it is that you're buying whatever it is you're buying, how do you really know what it is you're getting?
Well, I mean, I think you do know, you do have to educate yourself as a consumer, and you do have to read labels and pay attention. But I agree, getting out of the supermarket, if you can, if you're interested enough to do it, is really, really important. All sorts of interesting things happen at the farmer's market beyond the exchange of money for food. You learn a lot about how your food is produced. Your kids learn a lot about where your food comes from. They learn that a carrot is not a glossy orange bullet, you know, that comes in a plastic bag, but it's actually a root. And, you know, city meets country, and a great deal of information is exchanged. You learn how to cook things. You try new varieties. So I think that, you know, even if you just do it for a couple months in the summer, a great deal of good things happen at the farmer's market. And there is a movement out of the supermarkets. The supermarkets are really not doing very well these days. People are looking for alternatives. People are going to Whole Foods, an organic supermarket. And, you know, I mean, Whole Foods is a mixed bag, but you can really find some alternatives to conventional food there. And they do, it's true, have a lot of industrial organic food from California, but they are now making a real effort to support local farmers, or so they've announced. We'll see if, you know, if they actually can walk the talk. But, you know, you do have to educate yourself. I mean, one of our problems as eaters is we're very careless and we're very thoughtless. And we know so much more about the kind of car we're going to buy or the kind of sneakers we're going to buy than we do about the food we're putting in our bodies. So, you know, what I argue for, I don't really tell people in the book what they should eat, but I do argue for informing yourself and being a little more conscious about what is one of your most important relationships with the rest of the world, which is what you choose to put in your body and what you choose not to put in your body. You know, we have a food system really based on ignorance and haste and the real kind of fleeting pleasures of fast food, you know, about which people know very little. I don't think it's a burden to know more about your food or to meet your farmer or to go to a farmer's market. I actually find it's one of the great pleasures of life, and that the food tastes better when you know where it comes from. And when you eat that burger that came from a grass-finished steer, and you know the kind of place where that animal lived, and it wasn't living in manure on a feedlot for the last 6 months of its life, that burger will give you a whole lot more pleasure.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I have a few questions about organic beef, poultry, etc. It's my understanding that while it may be fed organic corn, that it is not stuffed full of antibiotics and things of that sort and growth hormones, which I think are very disastrous for the average eater in this country. And so I wondered if you knew whether penicillin and the antibiotics and the hormones that are given to poultry and to cattle, is that absent in organic?
Yes, it is, actually. And it's a very good point that I wish I had made. I'm really glad you brought it up, because that is one of the key differences in organic animal production, is that you're not allowed to give them hormones, growth hormones. You're not allowed to give them antibiotics. And that drives some other changes, too, because if you can't give your chicken or cattle antibiotics, you have to be a little more careful about how they live. You cannot have them living quite as packed together in filthy circumstances, because they'll get diseased. So there is more care taken to give them more space and to give them cleaner environments in which to live. But that is significant, you know, not eating meat that hasn't been pumped up with pharmaceuticals, which is the case with most industrial meat. So, yes, that's another good argument for buying organic, even if it's industrial.
Another question is, I know that, unfortunately, in this country that we feed them, the innards and the remains of other beef, we feed that to our cattle, and that, as disgusting as that sounds, is that absent in the organic, quote, organic beef and poultry?
Yes, in the case of poultry. I mean, you know, poultry are they are omnivores themselves. They eating meat is not unquestionable for them, because they do eat bugs and things like that. But I believe in the organic rules, certainly for cattle, the feed must be vegetarian. They're not getting byproducts. They're not getting manure from chickens, which is often the case in conventional production. And I think it's true, but I'm not 100% sure in the case of the chickens. But that there are real rules about the food, and the animals are getting better quality feed.
Good. I just wanted to make a plug for an article that used to show up weekly in one of our free newspapers. It was called Slow Food, and the gentleman who wrote it was very much into shopping locally, going to farmers markets, you know, finding sustainable local farmers who are doing away with pesticide and things of that sort. And I can't remember the name of the author, but I always enjoyed his article. And then that magazine kind of folded, and it was replaced by a buy, eat, 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 drink, drink, drink newspaper that was also free. And so it's like, if anybody's listening from that organization, I think they should include that Slow Food author in their newspaper. So forgive me for taking a minute to plug somebody else's work.
Let me just say a word about Slow Food. I actually think Slow Food is I don't know how familiar your listeners are with it, but it's a very interesting movement to counter the fast food culture that we live in. And we talked at the beginning of the hour about the lack of a food culture or the collapse of a food culture. And one of the things Slow Food is doing, it's an Italian-born movement that now has chapters all over America. And you can check out their website. I think it's called slowfoodusa.com, is to rebuild a food culture and remind people the pleasures of eating communally and not alone in your car, and the pleasures of eating traditional varieties of different foods, and highlighting local food cultures around the country where they're just wonderful, very specific to regions, food cultures, whether it's a way of eating or a particular food or variety of a plant or animal, and reminding people what we have in this country. So it's definitely worth checking out. It's a wonderful antidote to the way things are going.
All right, I appreciate the call. Let's go to somebody in Champaign, someone else in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have a problem. I used to eat natural vanilla ice cream. It was made of cream, milk, sugar, and natural vanilla bean. Now, all ice cream is labeled natural. It starts off with milk, so we're eating ice milk. And it contains guar gum, carrageenan, xanthan, carrabeen gum, and tarragum. Now, tell me, what is the word of natural today, and what is this junk they have in it? I don't eat it anymore.
Well, it's true that that simple product of ice cream has gotten really complicated.
But how can they call it natural?
Well, I think you have to beware of the word natural. The word natural in the
supermarket used to mean something.
It used to mean something. It really doesn't mean anything now. When it comes to meat production, it means a little bit. It means that no drugs are used on the animals. But in the case of the rest of the food store, it doesn't mean anything. It's not like organic, and that's one of the reasons that they ended up kind of setting the organic rules in stone, was because they didn't want to see the word organic go the way of the word natural.
But it is true
that you know, carrageenan and xanthan gum and all these additives, some of which you will find in organic food, by the way, make food cheaper. Basically, they give the consistency of.
But nobody knows what they're saying.
No, they don't, and most people don't know what these things are, and we don't know what these things do to us. But they give the consistency of a high buttermilk butterfat content to ice cream without using the actual high butterfat. So it's just a way to save money for food companies. And you know, my rule of thumb is if any product has more than five ingredients on the label or has more than one that I can't pronounce or don't know what it means, I don't buy it. I mean, food that's processed. That is processed to that extent is something to stay away from.
Well, we have to eat something. Why doesn't the government do something about this?
Well, because the government is captive of the food industry by and large, and the drug industry, and you know, they're not listening to us about the content of our food unless we really protest in some ways. So you know, the food industry is one of the most powerful in Washington. It's a $500 billion industry in this country.
And we don't know what they're doing to us.
No, we don't. And that's why we have to take control back. And we have to not buy processed food, and we have to, you know, buy, you know, get out of the supermarket.
But nobody talks about it, so nobody knows.
Well, that's why I wrote this book. Oh. I'm trying to spread the word.
Do you have these substances in there, guar gum, carrageenan, xanthan, carrabeen, and tara?
I talk about them. It's not a you know, book designed to help you read a label, but I talk a lot about why food is so heavily processed and what the problem is with heavily processed food. There are some other kind of consumer guides to food additives that you might want to take a look at.
Yeah.
And in fact, I talk about them in the bibliography. But there are books that go through it ingredient by ingredient. And in fact, I do that with a couple products. I do that with a chicken nugget, and I analyze what is in it. There are 37 ingredients in a chicken nugget, and some of them will scare the bejesus out of you. Some of them are you know, come from petroleum, not from food. There is a derivative of butane, lighter fluid, used to preserve a chicken nugget. There are chemicals in there that in tiny doses make people very sick. So, you know, the overprocessing of our food is a tremendous problem. You're absolutely right.
Are they still using nitrates in meat?
No, sure. Yeah.
How do we know that?
Well, they do have to label nitrates. You will find that on the label.
They don't tell you anything.
No, nitrates are, if you look on a prepackaged, you know, hot dogs or bacon, you will find it. But you'll also find alternatives. You can find Niman Ranch bacon that has no nitrates in it. So, you know, again, it's about reading labels carefully. The great thing is, the reason we live in good times in terms of food as well as bad is that the alternatives are out there. And if we will patronize those alternative food chains, they will grow bigger and stronger. And that's really, you know, the consumer, we can't wait for the government to help us here. The consumer has to seek out alternatives and support them.
But why don't they put this in the paper so people know? Well, I thank you very much.
All right.
Well, you're welcome, and good luck shopping.
One thing I wanted to mention here is that for people, for example, in our area that are interested in patronizing local producers, obviously one thing that you can do is go to the farmer's market. But also, I know that some folks at the University of Illinois, and I apologize, I'm looking here on the web to see if I can find more information. I do know that some folks here at the university within, and I believe this was in the College of ACES, the Ag School, have put together a directory of local producers. And I'm thinking that perhaps through the local extension office, such a thing would still be available, or maybe through the University of Illinois. I guess I'm just not sure. Maybe there's somebody who's listening who could tell us that. But it was a really nice directory for people here kind of in and around the Champaign area and Champaign County where those local producers were.
Well, I would also point you to, there's a couple national websites where you can type in your zip code and it will produce lists of local producers that live near you. And if you go to my website and look under the links page, I list some of those websites. My website is michaelpollan.com, P-O-L-L-A-N.
Okay.
And if you go to links, there's a downloadable sheet that gives you a lot of resources to find good local producers in your area. There's something called the eatwellguide.com where you can do that. So that's you know, there's some very good tools out there. The internet has helped connect these local producers with local consumers in ways that was never possible before.
Just I want to try and get some more callers here, but to continue with this point, we talked a little earlier in the conversation about the fact that, you know, one of the things that perhaps the industrial food system could boast about in this country is that food is really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of foods that maybe we're talking about, those that are produced in a different sort of way, may well be more expensive. And so the question becomes, is that when we talk about sustainable, and that may be another one of those terms that maybe mean different things to different people. We talk about sustainable ag practices and producing the kind of food that perhaps a lot of people would want. Is it possible for the producer to actually make a decent living doing that and to sell the food at a price that most people are going to be able to pay?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, people growing organically and people growing sustainably are doing better than conventional farmers these days, by and large, because they're in a niche where the consumer will pay more money. Even though it costs more to grow organically, you get a substantially higher price for your food. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people are converting to organic. But, you know, no question, the food that is better for you is going to cost more. And I have two basic, you know, responses to that. One is that we're not spending enough on food. We have been kind of brainwashed to think that food should be dirt cheap. You know, pile it high and sell it cheap is the motto of, you know, food company, of supermarkets. You know, what a horrible idea. We don't sell any other product that way. Every other product, we understand that you know, that old expression, you get what you pay for. And that is as true for food as it is for cars, for clothing, for anything you buy. For some reason, though, our food system is based on quantity rather than quality. It doesn't have to be that way. So for the people who can afford it, and, you know, that's about, say, 80% of us, I think we just have to dig down a little deeper and spend more on food to support our farmers, to support our health, and there's no way around it. The other point I would make is that cheap food only seems cheap. It is cheap at the register, but we pay an enormous price for cheap food in our health, to the environment, to the public purse. That cheap food is heavily subsidized by our government. So it's not as cheap as it looks. You pay in other ways. We're even paying in the Middle East, you know, to secure the supply of oil with our military so that we can grow cheap food, which takes fossil fuel fertilizer and fossil fuel to process and fossil fuel to drive around the country. So the real cost of cheap food is exorbitant. Cheap food is incredibly expensive if you really look at all the costs. Lastly, I would say that there is a role for government policy to fix this system. The way that our subsidies for agriculture are set up, we are subsidizing the least healthy calories in the supermarket. We are subsidizing the highly processed corn-based food. We're subsidizing, in effect, high fructose corn syrup. We're not subsidizing organic food. We're not subsidizing produce at all. whether it's organic or conventional. So to help people who can't afford to spend more, we have to design a system where the healthier calories can compete with the unhealthy calories in the supermarket. And that's a role for Congress. Congress really needs to do this. So agricultural policy, the Farm Bill, is where this fight also has to be played out.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies to a couple of calls we can't take. Just before we go, though, I want to mention someone heard my plea about the local farm directory and called in with the information. And if you do have access to the Internet, there is a website that you can look at. It's Illinois Farm Direct. So www.IllinoisFarmDirect, all is one word, .org. And it's a directory of locally produced and locally sold foods. And this is something that's been put together by the folks in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, and also folks in Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. So that, if as long as you have Internet access, you can do that and find out where people are locally producing foods that you might want to check out. So that's one way to go. And, of course, you can look at the book here we've talked about. It's The Omnivore's Dilemma by our guest Michael Pollan. It's published by the Penguin Press. And, Mr. Pollan, thank you very much.
My great pleasure to be here, David. Thank you.